And we are back with another segment of The Reporter's File. Many thanks for joining us. I'm Saeed Pourreza on this program. The controversial ban on the headscarf in Turkey. The status of Afghan women in Afghan society. Tunisia's olive oil industry, and citizenship rights violations in the UK. A ban on the headscarf worn by Muslim women has outraged members of the Turkish Muslim community. The ban, which has been in place since the creation of Turkey in 1923, has brought thousands of people onto the streets demanding religious freedom. Our first report by Serena Shin.
Turkey's population is 97.8% Muslim. However, there is a ban on the hijab in the public sector. The hijab is a Muslim woman's form of dress code, consisting of a piece of cloth to cover the hair in order to promote her modesty. The hijab is an obligation on all Muslim women by God, according to the Quran. Since Turkey's population is 97.8% Muslim, many people here are wondering why a so-called democratic government would appease less than 3% of the population. Press TV took to the streets to find out how the Turkish population feels about the ban. After talking with several people, like this gentleman here, it appears they find the ban discriminative towards women and their religious freedoms.
According to Turkish law, women are not allowed to wear the hijab or long clothing in the workplace. Women work just as hard as men and are entitled to their own freedom. We need to allow freedoms so women can work in government institutions.
Turkey's Government Workers Confederation has put together a petition aimed at trying to eliminate the ban. According to Turkish law, the headscarf is not allowed to be worn in any government jobs, including lawyers, judges, parliamentarians, hospital personnel, and school teachers. Press TV met up with the president of the Government Workers Confederation in Istanbul.
Ülke olarak her geçen gün demokrasiye doğru hızlı adımlar atıyoruz.
In 1982, the hijab was banned completely. In 2009, we had a referendum and many parts of the constitution had been changed. Now our government is trying to write a new constitution. We want the ban lifted in the name of the values of this country and in the name of democracy.
The Government Workers Union has started a petition to try and get 10 million signatures and put pressure on the Turkish parliament to lift the ban on the headscarf. At the function, we ran into Melek Bas, who is a lawyer. She told us about her trials and tribulations of trying to fulfill her job in Turkey.
I'm a lawyer, and I work for government and special place, and they closed eyes. Allah says you have to wearing scarf, and we believe Allah. And this country's people, maybe 97% Muslim. Right. We cannot explain why this new country's idea is we have to modeling Western country.
The ban is not only limited to the labor field, but in schools as well. Primary and secondary school students are not allowed to wear the hijab, except for in religious class. Many people believe the Turkish government is contradicting the very same religion they are teaching their students. University students legally are not allowed to wear the hijab. However, a lighter attitude is taken towards them, as many students began to leave Turkey to other countries where they were able to express their religious freedoms.
In the past, we cannot go to school with scarf. And now freedom a little bit light. Muslim woman wants more freedom, especially in this country. Inshallah, we get freedom.
Protests have been thrown throughout the entire country several times about the issue. These women you see in the images are calling on their government to allow them the religious freedoms they claim have been stripped from them.
Bu 1960 yılında yapılan.
There is no problem on the ground when it comes to the hijab. However, this problem has still not been solved in the legal arena, and that is what we are trying to do.
Amid the move to lift the headscarf ban in the public sector, the commission responsible for drafting a new constitution has not yet taken any action regarding the issue. Many people demand that headscarf freedom be protected in the new constitution. Without such a legal guarantee, it is felt that a ban on the headscarf in the public sector and a prohibition that was revoked on university campuses could continue. Serena Shim, Press TV, Istanbul.
Our next report takes us to Afghanistan. Women in Afghan society are said to be facing major threats, among them domestic violence. They're also being taken advantage of by the so-called international women's rights organizations active in the country. Our next report by Amin Alami.
The life of an Afghan woman is a tale of pain and suffering. In remote areas of her country, deep-rooted traditions dictate to her how she should live. The birth of a son is welcomed with open arms and celebrated with parties and funfare. But if the newborn turns out to be a girl, it's a whole different story. She'll open her eyes to hatred, humiliation. She is an unwanted, unwelcome new arrival. That's the story of thousands of women in Afghanistan.
Afghan women are always being confined to a conservative society and unacceptable innovations here that deprive women from their basic rights.
During the school period, when one can be 7 to 18, thousands of the Afghan girls cannot go to school due to lack of the culture of respect to women's rights and many more challenges like insecurity, shortage of built schools, or the threats coming from the Taliban militants as they are opposed to education for girls and women in Afghanistan. The Taliban has repeatedly attacked to school girls in southern Kandahar, northern Tahar, central Ghazni, and many other provinces to force them to leave education. In such circumstances, women rights activists not only condemn such terrorist attacks, but they also blame the Afghan government and its Western supporters for paying not enough attention to women rights, especially when it comes to the education issue for Afghan women.
The Afghan government has not prioritized women's problems very much for different reasons, such as insecurity, something that is of utmost importance for them.
Meanwhile, the Afghan government says that during 11 years after the ouster of the Taliban regime and growth of what the government named democracy here, they could achieve important goals in women's rights sections such as creation of Women Affairs Ministry, holding of hundreds of information workshops and many more.
The establishment of our own ministry and the Independent Human Rights Commission that are involved in supporting women here are our key achievements since the ouster of the Taliban regime in 2001.
But all these claims highlighted by the Afghan officials present symbolic role of the government on the issue of women's rights in Afghanistan, says this political commentator.
The Afghan Ministry of Women Affairs have always had very symbolic activities. It's not enough to rely only on public awareness programs to decrease violence against women.
Along with the creation of post-Taliban government in Afghanistan in 2001, women rights violence has seen an increase among the Afghan society. Family violence is known as another problem on the way of women here. Sometimes the outcome of such violence appears as a forced marriage, running from home, sexual crimes, suicide, or even self-burning. But what remains as a puzzle is the no positive impact of the presence of tens of so-called women rights organizations and shelter houses on the lives of Afghan women.
Afghans not only doubt that these so-called international women rights organizations and shelter houses could really lead the Afghan women to tackle the problems they are facing with, but they blame them for struggling to misuse the minds of Afghan women, most of them illiterate, under the pretext of protecting them from different threats and violence to lead them to follow the Western culture.
In many cases, when an Afghan woman faced with a big problem like sexual abuse, running out from home, all these same examples, she tries to find a sanctuary in a shelter house. But all these shelter houses safe for such women?
The operations of these so-called international shelter houses are not only against to our religious values and culture, but they have also doubled the problems of women here.
Even in an optimistic look to the shelter houses in Afghanistan, the low number of these shelter houses could not meet even a small fraction of the need in a country where a high percentage of marriages are forced and 87% of women face at least one form of physical, sexual or psychological violence or forced marriage in their lifetimes. And this can undoubtedly undermine the slogans of the international community regarding to protection of Afghan women from different threats.
Such operations, I think, have not addressed the problems of Afghan women. Instead, they have doubled violence against them. Irrelevant slogans from the so-called human rights activists have further caused violence against women here.
In the eyes of Afghans, the reasons for the increase in women rights violation is not only limited to mismanagement of women rights affairs. Many here say the creation of tens of private TV channels and radio stations which are not broadcasting in according to the Afghan culture could be counted as one of the most important factors in this issue. For Reporters File, Amin Alami, Kabul.
Tunisians are proud of their extra virgin olive oil. Production of the golden liquid is a long process that begins in olive groves and ends in the mills. Adnan Shoshi has a look at it.
Thousands of acres of green olive groves are the treasure of farmers in the north of Tunisia. From fall to the midwinter season, men and women work for 10 hours a day to collect the precious olives. Like thousands of farmers, the Neji family braves the cold weather conditions and works silently to sustain themselves and the whole nation. These people are mere strangers to the consumers, but familiar to the land and the olive trees.
Recent statistics have shown a stark contradiction between the growing number of the unemployed that has reached 800,000 people and the alarming lack of workforce in agriculture.
Fraj Ben Arfa supervises the work of dozens of employees. The old man was raised in the olive groves, where he learned the skills that the new generations refuse to acquire.
2 years ago, more than 100 people worked in this field. Less than 50, mostly old women, have accepted to participate in this season. The young have the energy, but not the will.
The agricultural production in Tunisia relies on the effort of women. They are respected for their devotion to hard work and discipline. Lost in the huge agricultural lands, Neji El Aswad picks up the olives for people she will never meet. She claims her readiness to sacrificing time and energy for the protection of the sacred olive tree.
I acknowledge that our job is tiring and challenging, as we no longer have the energy of the youth, but we remain patient because this successful olive season is a gift from the Almighty.
We've driven through the beautiful landscape of the north to reach one of the oldest oil mills in the country, in the remote town of Sabelat Ben Ammar.
From November to the end of January, oil presses will be working for 24 hours a day to provide the best extra virgin oil in the Mediterranean. local producers insist that it's the best in the world.
For 50 years, Abdelaziz Frashishi has been working here. He remembers the good and the bad seasons, but insists on the unique aspect of the Tunisian olive oil.
I spent my life between the groves and the oil mills. Our climate is stable and the land is rich. Therefore, our golden olive oil is the best in the world.
Ajmi Marga is an activist and expert in olive oil who is fighting for the rights of his countrymen. He claims that the local extra virgin oil is distributed by foreign companies on the international market as a European product. Ajmi calls on the authorities to protect the Tunisian producers.
For decades, we have been calling on the government to pack the extra virgin olive oil before they export abroad. Some foreign oil mills sell our product and pretend that it's European.
Murad Ben Amar is the well-known and respected olive oil producer and landowner. His grandfather, Tahar, was the last prime minister under French colonization. He signed the Tunisian Independence Treaty from France in 1956. Since then, the Ben Amar family left the political scene and devoted its energy to agriculture.
I have recently modernized the machines. This oil mill is 100 years old. It's a treasure that I have inherited from my ancestors. Each corner has a story. In a few years, my son will be taken over.
Murad says that the increase in the prices of gas and fertilizers has added extra charges that farmers who've sold their lands and mills could not bear anymore. All the same, he remains optimistic and keen on safeguarding the tradition of the forefathers.
Things have changed over the past 5 years. The workforce has become rare and expensive. There are too many expenses and challenges. Some producers have abandoned their lands and oil mills, but we are still here. We are proud and we will never give up. Never.
¥1,190 is the estimated quantity of olives for this season. It represents about 240,000 tons of liquid oil. In comparison with last year, the 27% increase in production will provide local and international markets with an exceptional and healthy olive oil, which comes from sacred trees that people live to serve and die to see in good hands. Nowadays, landowners, ordinary farmers and consumers celebrate the beginning and the end of the olive season because our ancestors transmitted their love and passion for the sacred olive tree to millions of Tunisians. Adin Shawishi for Reporters File, Benzert.
Does your citizenship protect you from other countries? Well, you think it should, but in Britain, for instance, an extradition treaty with the US is questioning the very foundation of citizenship and the country's legal system. In the past few months, a number of Muslim men, for instance, have been extradited to the U.S., while a non-Muslim man has been spared. Nargis Mbalighi takes a look at accusations of double standards and whether in Britain some people are viewed differently than others.
After a legal battle that had taken years, on the 5th of October 2012, Britain's High Court ruled that five men can be extradited to the United States. Each one had a different story. The media and the politicians focused on one radical cleric, Abu Hamza, who had been convicted in the UK. But they largely skimmed over the story of two British citizens, Barbara Ahmed and Tala Assan, who have never been convicted in this country and whose ultimate fate leaves a question mark hanging over British justice.
Before being extradited under a controversial treaty with the US, 38-year-old Barbara Ahmed had been in a UK jail for 8 years, 33-year-old Tala Assan for 6. Neither of them had ever been charged. The British police jailed them on the orders of American authorities, who accused them of running a jihadist website. Their stories have been long and complex. After his first arrest, the police admitted to a serious and prolonged attack on Barbara Ahmed that left him with 73 injuries. Tala Assan, meanwhile, has Asperger's syndrome, a form of autism. Evidence has been passed to America without ever being checked in the UK. But despite all these question marks, the extradition went ahead.
It's been 2 weeks since Barbara and Tala have been extradited, and what was ruled impossible for them has happened for another British citizen, Gary McKinnon. He, like Barbara and Tala, has been accused by the US of computer-related activity. He, like Tala, has Asperger's syndrome. But Gary has just had his extradition abandoned by Home Secretary Theresa May on human rights grounds. His lawyers are based here, and the media is waiting to hear their reaction.
It's still incredibly emotional.
One by one, they praised Theresa May for her courage. For Gary's mother, Janice, it was an emotional moment after a decade-long fight for her son.
Sorry. It's been an emotional roller coaster, so I'm not very articulate today. I'm overwhelmed, incredibly happy. I want to say thank you, Theresa May, because it was an incredibly brave decision to stand up to another nation as strong and powerful as America. It's rare, and she had the guts to do it. And I always felt that she had the strength to come through and do this, and to also change the extradition treaty. To bring in forums so that this hopefully won't happen to anyone else.
And we had another appointment for visiting.
But it had just happened to someone else, to Tala Assan. His mother, Farida, sat down with me for a rare interview. She told me she was overjoyed for Gary and his family. But the contrast between the endings for these two families is raw and real. Where I witnessed tears of joy in Gary's mother, I witnessed tears of pain as I asked Farida about the last time she saw her son.
He was always a strong boy. He never shows any. But at the last moment, he couldn't stop it. He's a human also. And he's crying. At the last moment, he's telling his sister, "Oh, you, my sister, always loved me, and you are always nice to me." And also, he told Hamza so many things, "Be careful." And then he had his brother, his father, me, and he was telling, "Father, father, pray for me."
Human rights organisations like the IHRC, while welcoming the halt to Gary McKinnon's extradition, have slammed what they call the double standards and hypocrisy of the government. They say the evidence is clear. British Muslims are being treated as second-class citizens.
There is this idea that if you are a Muslim, there are different standards that are going to apply to you. This has clearly shown that. Muslims are being treated as others in this community, and that the law needs to be applied somewhat differently to them compared to other people. And
I think not only is the treaty being implemented unequally, critics from across the board say the treaty itself is unequal in its essence.
This extradition treaty is unequal. So, for example, if America was to ask for an individual that lives in the UK to be taken over to the United States, there's no prima facie evidence that they need to provide in a court of law to say, well, actually, this person does have something to answer for in the United States. The UK should be able to have that same leverage and say, well, I want this individual to be brought over to the UK. The UK does not have that same leverage.
These bags are all that remains of Tala in Britain. They are unopened. His brother Hamja says it's too painful a task for the family to face.
This is all we've got left of Talha, actually, in this country. His prison cell was cleared as early as the 1st of October, so many days before the final verdict of the trial. His whole contents was cleared. Talha, you know, he wrote in prison, so it's all the drafts of his writing, it's his legal papers, it's all the letters people sent to him, and he received hundreds of letters of support. So I think it's still
that support continues now that Talha is in America. His family takes strength from that, but their hope for British justice has turned into a horrific ordeal.
It's been a very painful nightmare. The psychological ordeal of it is the uncertainty. We haven't heard a word from him. Talha used to call home every single day. Used to call his mother, used to call me. We haven't had a phone call, we haven't had a letter. We have no idea when that would be. It's been weeks.
For the families of Talha and Baba, it could be many more years of uncertainty and waiting. In America, they could face solitary confinement, plea bargaining, even the death penalty. It seems, in this case at least, British justice did not extend to all its citizens. Nagis Mobalari for Reporters File.
And that's your Reporters File once again. Many thanks for having been with us. Tell us how we're doing by sending us an email to reportersfile@presstv.ir. Until we meet again, goodbye.